This is Invest Talk from KPP Financial, helping investors make sense of the markets one day at a time. Here's your host, Luke Guerrero.
Good afternoon, fellow investors, and welcome back to Invest Talk. I'm your host, Luke Guerrero, and I wish you had a very relaxing weekend because it's time to dive back in. We have some work to do today. Before we move forward, though, I do want to remind you that our latest Invest Talk Wealth webinar, Beyond the Yield, is available now on our YouTube channel if you missed it. It's a presentation about how you can invest for your income needs, followed by answers to finance and investment questions. If you haven't checked it out yet, I encourage you to do so. Just head over to YouTube and type Invest Talk with two T's. Now, in just a bit, we'll talk about today's market performance and run down the show topics, but let's tackle this caller question now.
Hi, Invest Talk. I have a question about Comcast. I own the stock. It's a CNCSA. Could you please share your thoughts? Does it sell or hold? I will listen to your podcast, and thank you very much for all your help. Thanks. Bye.
Let's take a look at Comcast, that is ticker CMCSA, and that is a name that we actually hold in one of our strategies for our clients. It's actually in Target right now, or rather it's in the Target, but we don't yet hold it. And the reason why we never bought into it, well, I mean, the momentum has been really poor for quite some time. They're down 30.66% over the past 52 weeks, down 15.47% over the past 3 months. Now, I forgot to mention what the heck this company is. And what it is a media conglomerate, right? They have, as of now, their Xfinity. They have their business services. They got NBC Universal, Telemundo, Peacock Streaming, Universal Studios. But that is going to change soon because in mid-2027, they announced they are spinning off NBC Universal and Sky into a separate public company. Now, they announced this spinoff on, looks like, June 29th. And this new spinoff company is supposed to carry off $100 billion of its debt. Recently, they had an earnings beat both on top line revenue and bottom line earnings. They had a really strong February. The reason being, okay, you had a combination of, the Super Bowl, which drove revenue. It was NBC's time to host that. You had the Winter Olympics, which certainly was a big driver in revenue. But then when you go to their broadband business, they lost 65,000 customers. Now, the sad part is it's an improvement because a year prior they lost 183,000 customers, but it's a business that just has not been doing well thus far. Growing, yes, beating earnings, yes, but it has been struggling, and that's really one of the reasons why, you know, there has been an inability to sustain rallies over the past couple years. I think one of the worst things for this company right now is you have a bit of EBITDA margin compression. I mean, it's down from 30.2% to 27.5%. It's going to undergo probably the most significant restructuring since Warner Brothers Discovery was spun off by AT&T. If it works, whatever remains probably deserves a materially higher multiple than 6.6 times price to forward-looking earnings. But the momentum's really poor. It's why we've kept it on our watch list. In spite of that, I think there is some good stuff underneath the hood. Just got to wait for a bit of a technical turn. That is Comcast Corporation, ticker CMCSA. Thanks for the call. Well, we had a great show for you last Thursday. We looked into a story about what it really means when you say you own index funds or you own the index. We also answered a listener question on McDonald's that was submitted via our YouTube channel. If you happen to miss last Thursday's episode because Friday was a holiday, I encourage you to go check it out. And remember, the best way to never miss an episode is to subscribe to Invest Talk wherever you get your podcasts. On to today, where my main focus point will be about the Roth conversion window. The reason why we're talking about this is because mid-year is a pretty smart time to model conversions Before year-end tax planning starts to get rushed, so we'll take you on a practical walkthrough of who benefits, how to size a conversion, and the bracket management math that makes it all work. We also have another story about the dangers of what has really become a top-heavy economy, a little bit of a deep dive into Michael Saylor's MicroStrategy and why it's really a victim of his own math at this point. And should we have time at the end of the show, we'll touch on the potential fear, or rather the fuel, the fears of a potential earnings bubble. We also have some voice bank calls ready to play, including one on stock splits and another on the Vanguard Healthcare Index Fund ETF, that's VHT, as well as some questions that came in from the comment section of the InvestDoc YouTube channel, and hopefully we hear from some of you live throughout the show. Now, if you're headed into a break, it is a quick one, and when we come back, we have plenty more to talk about, and it all starts with our market wrap, so hang on.
You've got finance and investment questions, and the InvestDoc phone lines never close. Call anytime, 888-99-CHART.
Now, the market was definitely positive today, pretty much across the board. You had the S&P up 72, NASDAQ up 112, Russell 2000 up 45, and Dow up 30, coming off of a holiday shortened week that tends to take with it, you know, a bunch of liquidity. Overall, looks like breadth was positive, though if you actually looked at the S&P, those names, you had decliners outnumbering gainers, meaning the equal weight trailed, in this case by about 70 basis points. But the big story, or rather the big gainers, big winners, probably semi-memory, I mean, those are the big outperformers. You had AI infrastructure and big tech doing well, tech hardware, another good performer, pharma, managed care, home builders. I mean, so those were some of your worst performers on the day. So those names that really rotated into last week had a bit of a rough day. On the bond side, treasuries were mostly firmer. You did see some curve steepening, specifically on the front end where yields were down about 5 to 6 basis points. Sorry, my cat's going crazy. Dollar index was flat. Gold and silver both finished up about 1 and 2.1% respectively. But really that big story, and I alluded to it at the top, was that momentum rebound. Because we had, coming into this week, you had a two-day slump that saw that software index drop more than 11%. I mean, that is a huge drawdown. And the reality is, there wasn't really much behind it, right? You didn't have any specific catalysts other than a lot of discussion maybe about how much the drawdown had overextended itself and a bit of a positive seasonality on the forefront. You did have within individual names positive news, Broadcom announcing that it was extending its deal with Apple, some infrastructure names talking about potential revenue growth into the next quarter. And so broadening out trade really took a breather. Other than that, not much really going on. You did have some data come in. June ISM services was in line with the consensus. The employment index was back into expansion territory. But, you know, with the exception of Wednesday, where we get May wholesale inventories and the June FOMC, I mean, it's a pretty quiet week. You do get initial claims, existing home sales on Thursday. Tomorrow we get the May trade balance, but nothing much scheduled for Friday. So if anything, a bit of a lull heading off of the holiday weekend. All right, let's try and squeeze in another question before we head into another break. This one from the comment section of the InvestTalk YouTube channel. It says, I own some picks and shovel companies for AI. Thoughts on ATI, TSMC at these current prices? How are their current valuations? All right, let's take a look at ATI first. ATI is actually a name we hold in one of our strategies. ATI is ATI Inc. It is up 121.14% over the past 52 weeks. It's just going crazy this year, up 67.36. It's a specialty metals company, so they essentially manufacture all of these high-performance alloys, not just for energy infrastructure, right? That's been a big thing. Nuclear reactors is another big theme that has gone along with the AI theme, but also defense systems, jet engines. And they've seen a bunch of growth specifically in aerospace and defense. I mean, that makes up 68% of their overall revenue. And with this run-up, I mean, it is looking a bit expensive. It's just off of their average. It's trading about 14 and a half times price to book value, about 38.3 times price to forward-looking earnings. So certainly it's a bit more expensive than it has been. But that's understandable when a name is up so much. And, you know, one of the good things about this name is they have a huge backlog. And anytime you get a company that has a backlog of orders, you essentially have revenue visibility, in this case, for many years. And not only are they growing revenue, I mean, margins are expanding. So they're up from 16% in EBITDA margin in 24 to 17.7 this year, projected to grow further to 21%. And it's meaningful growth there. Again, I like that name. We like that name. There's a reason why we own it for clients. So yeah, I would say one issue, we bought it a while ago. I'd say one issue for entering a new position is just valuations. But, you know, certainly ATI is a good name for your portfolio. Fortunately, we got to move on. Didn't have time to take care of two stocks. But we do have time to take care of another listener voicemail from 888-99-CHART.
I was wondering your opinion about Leggett and Platt, symbol LEG. Wanted to see what your thoughts were on the company and if you thought there was a good entry point. Thank you. Bye.
Leggett and Platt is a name that we get questions on, honestly, a lot. And what they do is they manufacture furniture and engineered components for homes, for offices, for automobiles. It's pretty diversified. About 38% of their revenue comes from bedding, another 34% from furniture and flooring, the rest from what they call specialized products, and that includes their automobile segment. Last quarter, revenue was actually down 10% year over year. They had half of that from divesting from certain businesses. Half of that was just an organic decline in revenue. EBIT fell, so that's earnings before interest and taxes, about 29%. Operating cash flow went from being negative to positive, or I'm sorry, fell $56 million. And the reason being is, you know, there is weak demand really across their home building segment. You also had guidance withdrawn, not in this quarter, but the most recent one. And it's in poor technical position. It's consolidating around $11. You know, it's up 7.27% this year, up 20.90 in the past 3 months. It's trying to break out here. I'm not convinced it can. So for now, I'd probably keep it on my watch list. Thanks for the call. This is InvestTalk, and our work continues after this break. But I encourage you to call now or anytime at 888-99-CHART.
Got a question for Justin or Luke? You're the best person to ask it.
I wanted to pick your brain about Apple. What did you think about their earnings call? Is this a good time to add to my position?
Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
The numbers are in. Total lifetime downloads for the InvestTalk podcast have now surpassed 63 million. So tell your friends, when they've got finance and investment questions, don't forget to call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
Let's go to Robert from Pleasanton. Looks like you got a question about AT&T. You own it, or are you looking to buy it?
I'm looking to buy it. I know it's been beat up pretty badly. I know there's been some concern about SpaceX and, you know, what that company could possibly mean for AT&T's mm-hmm. future going forward. But I'm just wondering if this sell-off is a little bit overdone at this point, or is this a classic falling knife situation to avoid?
Yeah, that's a great question. The reason why you are right to be a little skeptical here is because this thing's down 27% over the past year. It has not been doing well. AT&T, of course, is the telecom and technology services company, massive, massive telecom giant. They have 23 million postpaid subscribers from their wireless segment, and they got AT&T Fiber. They are also expanded into emerging markets more aggressively in the past couple years. But it's falling in spite of revenue being up 3% year over year, which was a beat, in spite of earnings per share at about 57 cents versus 55, which was not only a year over year increase, but also another beat. You know, I think there's a couple things going on here. The first is one that you mentioned, which is the potential for different replacements for how we think about wireless carrier service, right? I mean, for this company, the huge, huge portion of the revenue, about 71% of the revenue comes from mobile. So if a company like Starlink or another company became a legitimate alternative, that would certainly hurt this business. And that hurts the entire sector. I think what is hurting AT&T specifically, they have so much debt. They have a ridiculous amount of debt, $146 billion in debt. And so at a time where over the past month you've had a re-rating of interest rates and the interest rate expectations, a company that has this much debt is going to underperform because of the cost of financing that debt is going up relative to what expectations have been. I think it's the largest driver. They especially took on a bunch of debt in that Lumen acquisition recently. And you're seeing it affect their income statement as well. I mean, free cash flow has fallen about 19% year over year. And so those two things put together kind of make an interesting situation here for not just a sector that hasn't done well, but a company that is really just brutally in a tough spot. So for me, I have a little bit of difficulty kind of wanting to get into telecoms in general. But aside from what's affecting the sector, I think this company just got too much debt in a time when rates are probably going to be higher than people expected. So I would pass. It's languishing. It's probably likely to continue to do that until they figure out their debt situation. Thanks for the call. All right, let's talk about capital flows. One thing that has been kind of nagging me is that they're getting bigger. And they're not getting bigger in a non-meaningful way. It's dramatically bigger. You have major mega mergers worth over $10 billion, actually accounting for 48% of total deal value this year. And that's the highest amount that has been ever recorded. You have venture capital rounds that are exceeding $1 billion, being 61% of total venture funding, 4/5 of them involving other corporate investors. Everything seems to be supersized, right? You had SpaceX raising its $86 billion IPO. You had DeepSeek raising $7 billion in a single round. Alphabet selling about $80 billion in stock, which effectively is a rounding error for a $4.4 trillion company, but that's still really meaningful. And then something we've been talking about for a while, you have those hyperscalers that are expected to spend 8/10 of a $1 trillion just this year alone. And so if any of these things, I guess, were happening alone in isolation, it would be interesting. But the fact that all these things are happening at the same time makes it a bit more questionable, right? You have all of these forces converging, yet corporate profits relative to GDP are still near all-time highs. You have record market valuations. And so what's concerning me is until recently, the hyperscalers and all these companies funded a lot of these things from operating cash flow. Now they're borrowing a lot of money. Amazon's debt to free cash flow ratio has gone from below the S&P average in 2019 to more than 4 times the average today. I mean, the top decile of listed companies by value now account for over 3/4 of total market cap. That's the highest concentration in a century, meaning that the failure of just one debt-laden corporate giant would effectively cause incredible disruption, not just for that company, but across the board. And another portion of this, something that people aren't really saying, is that when these boardrooms are collectively deciding that bigger is better and using inflated stock and cheap confidence to acquire everything in sight, that's historically been the late stage of cycles. And so looking at all this, I'm a bit concerned. I'm a bit concerned, understandably, because if you don't understand the history of where these things have been, then you ignore the risks that are out there. And the growth of capital is certainly one of them. On the next Invest Talk, we'll look into what happens when the AI bubble pops, because the trade seems to be losing steam. That story tomorrow. But for now, I'm Luke Guerrero, ready to take your calls anytime at 888-99-CHART.
At KPP Financial, accountability means more than advice. It means we invest alongside you. Through our parallel investing approach, when we recommend an investment for clients, one or more KPP principals invest their own capital at the same time. Same day, same price, same percentage. If your portfolio moves, ours does too. That is alignment. That is transparency. That is the KPP difference. Visit investtalk.com to get your free portfolio review.
In the early days, InvestTalk was Jerry Klein and Steve Peasley. Now the torch has been passed and a new generation of hosts is on the job. Justin Klein and Luke Guerrero. So when you've got finance and investment questions, don't forget to call InvestTalk. 888-99-CHART.
Hi, Justin and Luke. Long time listener here to your great show, Matt from Minneapolis. I have a quick question for you, gentlemen. I know the healthcare has been going up, all those stocks and stuff in different areas, and I've heard you guys mention different healthcare stocks and funds and that, and I'm interested in just, I guess I found what I feel is a good fund to put my money into. I don't know if I'll have the time to monitor individual companies or not, but I was wondering, what's your opinion of VHT is the ticker symbol, Vanguard Healthcare Fund. It has quite a few holdings in it and looks to be doing pretty well so far this year. And I was just wondering what your thoughts and opinions are of this fund. I'll be glad to hear them and look forward to it on the show. Thank you. Have a good day.
Vanguard Healthcare ETF, ticker VHT, is, you guessed it, a healthcare ETF. It provides pretty broad exposure to healthcare companies and focuses solely on the United States. And like any Vanguard fund, it is cheap, about 9 basis points is its expense ratio. This one in particular has about 500 names. It's actually at 427 right now. And the top names are going to be the most familiar because this thing is weighted by market cap. So your top one is Eli Lilly. It's about 14% of the portfolio. J&J is 8.4. AbbVie is 6. United Health Group's 5.5. Merck, about 4.63. Now, over the longer term, over the long time frame, this thing does exactly how the benchmark is going to do. One thing that I would note, right, healthcare had for a while been beaten up until really recently, until this rotation kind of started mid last month. The reason being is, well, money was chasing AI and money had to come somewhere. Then you couple that with medical costs crushing managed care margins. You had regulatory uncertainty from pricing reform and what the One Big Beautiful Bill Act would do. And I mean, honestly, it's still a bit of a hangover in the healthcare space from the pandemic. And so healthcare wasn't doing well. Now it's doing better now. I think that people who have been systematically underweight healthcare for good reasons probably want to look towards no longer being systematically underweight healthcare. And if you're looking to do it in a broad, diversified way, the Vanguard Healthcare ETF, ticker VHT, good way to go about it. Okay. Let's talk about a subject that isn't really headline grabby. It's not exciting. It's not the Fed. It's not Iran. It's not SpaceX. But it is something that is probably more applicable to your life. That's because the middle of the year is, I think, the ideal time to start to model a Roth conversion. And most people either don't know what that means, so we'll help you there, or think it doesn't apply to them. And so everybody needs a little bit of education here. Now, a Roth conversion moves money from a pre-tax retirement account, so your traditional IRA, your 401k, your 403b, and it puts it in a Roth. You pay the income tax on that converted amount the day that you want to convert, and in return, that money grows tax-free for the rest of your life. No taxes on withdrawals, no required minimum distributions, no unknown future tax rate overhang over your retirement math. Simple. You pay tax now, you know what rate you're paying, and you eliminate all of that uncertainty down the road. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act, which was signed actually last year, 1 year ago, July 4th, I believe, permanently extended the Tax Cut and Jobs Act tax brackets, meaning that the big fear of the sunset no longer existed. And for years, the pitch for Roth conversions was, well, convert before rates go up in 2026. Now, obviously, that urgency is gone, but it doesn't mean that there isn't a case for why you might want to convert. Because in reality, I would say there's actually a stronger foundation for why you may want to convert. The reason being is your personal tax rate is going up even if federal tax brackets don't change. Required minimum distributions, they start at 73 or 75 if you're born in 1960 or later. And once that kicks in, the IRS forces you to withdraw from your traditional IRA, whether you need the money or not. So if you've spent 30 years accumulating in pre-tax accounts, those forced withdrawals can push you into the 32-35% tax bracket. Then you add on Social Security, up to 85% of which becomes taxable at higher income levels. Now you're paying a tax rate in retirement that's higher than what you paid while you were working. That is the opposite of what the conventional wisdom promises. Now, the trough years, which are the years between when you retire and 73, that's the prime conversion window. Income is at its lowest. You're no longer earning a salary. RMDs, they haven't started. Social Security has not kicked in yet for people that decide to defer. Meaning that the gap is the widest your tax bracket's probably been for decades, and it's going to get narrower. It's the opportunity to fill it with those converted dollars at 22% or 24% instead of waiting for, you know, RMDs to essentially force that dollar amount to be taxed at 32%. That's a meaningful difference. Now, if you're a retiree between 60 and 73 and you have a significant traditional IRA or 401k balance, that's who benefits. Business owners who have variable income, they can benefit. You would want to do it in a low K 1 year. That's your conversion year, not a high K 1 year. If you're an early retiree in the FIRE community, you can build a conversion ladder to access funds penalty-free 5 years after each conversion. High earners who are in temporary low income years. If you're between jobs, you're on sabbatical, you're in a business downturn, that's when you want to convert. Pretty much anybody who expects that your tax rate is going to be the same or higher in retirement than it is now, you are the people who should be converting. So how does this work? Well, you don't want to do it all, right? This is where most people either overthink or underthink it, I guess. You want to bracket fill. You take your estimated bracket from 2026, your salary, your pension, your investment income, your Social Security, you identify which bracket you're in. Then you calculate how much room you have before you spill into the next bracket. That is your conversion amount. It's simple, a little bit complicated. That's why we help our clients do it. But in theory, it is simple. If you're a married couple that's filing jointly with $150,000 in taxable income, you're in the 22% bracket, which runs up to about $200,000. They would have roughly $51,000 of room. So your $51,000 of room there, that would cost you about $11,200 in federal tax. That 51,000 growing at 7% for 25 years becomes roughly 277,000 of completely tax-free money. Do that for 5 or 6 years and you've moved over 300,000 out of the IRS's reach. Now, keep in mind, it's not all easy. It's not all without landmines here. There are certainly dangers and risks. First, there's Irma. Medicare sets your Part B and Part D premiums based on your income from two prior years. So a Roth conversion in 2026 actually affects your 2028 premiums. Then there's the pro rata rule. If you have both deductible and non-deductible money in your traditional IRA, the IRS taxes the conversion proportionally across all your IRA balances, not just the portion you're converting. Then there's the issue that you pay the tax from outside funds, not from the IRA itself. And once you convert, it's permanent. Since 2018, you cannot recharacterize, so you can't undo it. So if unexpected income pushes you into a higher bracket after you've converted, you are out of luck. You're stuck with the bill. Bottom line, today's tax rates, pretty favorable by historical comparison, and they're now permanent under current law, but doesn't mean new laws aren't going to change them. Think about it. National debt just crossed 100% of GDP. Deficits are running at 6%. At some point, rates are going up. They have to. The fiscal math demands that they do. Every dollar you convert now at 22 or 24 is a dollar you will never pay at 28, 33, 39. And a $100,000 conversion growing at 7% for 25 years becomes over $500,000 of tax-free money. That is a meaningful amount that you can prepare to save today. As always, everybody's tax situation is different, so talk to your tax advisor, run the back bracket filling math by them, and remember, the best time to start planning is now. All right, let's keep things moving with another listener question from 888-99-CHART.
Hi, I'm calling about CAVA, C-A-V-A. I just wanted to know what you guys thought about its near-term future. Thanks a lot. Be listening on the program.
CAVA Group. Ticker CAVA is a restaurant that I used to eat at a lot. It's kind of like a fast, casual chain Mediterranean spot. So think Chipotle, but more Mediterranean focused. So you got your bowls, you choose what you want in the bowl. Pretty simple, pretty straightforward. It was a darling of Wall Street for a really long time, specifically retail. I mean, they IPO'd back in 23 at 38.15. One point they were trading at 150. Their price to forward-looking earnings was in the thousands at one point. Their price to book value was 33 for a Mediterranean Chipotle. So is that justified? I mean, right now they're trading a bit lower than they have been, 118 price to forward-looking earnings, 11 times price to book value. That is below their average, but their average is frankly insane. On an actual income perspective, revenue is up 32% year over year. Restaurant level profit margins were at 25%, which is actually pretty solid, but EBIT margin, not great. Supposed to contract from 6.7 to 4.8%. It's a very volatile name. I mean, over the past 52 weeks, they're down 16% in spite of them being up 22% year to date, in spite of them being down 12% over the past 3 months. On the plus side, their traffic growth is crazy, right? Like 6 to 7% traffic growth. I mean, that is far and above any other fast casual or even casual dining peer. They have a bunch of cash on their balance sheet, which is certainly a good thing. Almost $400 million. They have net debt of pretty much zero net debt. But at $71 per share, that's an expensive guy. The fundamentals are pretty much as clean as it gets within the fast casual space, but it's just too rich for me. It's too rich for me. They have upcoming earnings on August 18th, so it's still a month away. It's going to be interesting to see if, you know, the launch of their new products, the expansion plan they have, is bearing itself out in potentially raising guidance on margins, but still too expensive. I like their food, though. Thanks for the call. What are we going to do, guys? Let's do a voicemail.
Hey, guys. Love the podcast. I have a question about ExxonMobil, ticker symbol XOM, looking to buy it. Let me know what y'all think. Thank y'all.
ExxonMobil is one of the oil majors. I don't think I have to tell you what Exxon does. It is a name that we hold for clients in our portfolio, one of our portfolios, albeit at a smaller weight than they have, or rather than we have over the years. And in the wake of the Iran conflict, I mean, it skyrocketed. In February, this thing was trading at 148. By the end of March, it was at 170. Now it's back down to 136, but it's still up 21% over the past 52 weeks, up 13% year to date. Now, we like this name. We think that historically, when people buy energy positions, they sized primarily towards oil. And for a lot of reasons, the issues in the Middle East, more than anything, showed that there are tools that sovereign countries have in order to control oil prices. Think of all the crazy things that happened in the past couple months. Yet, oil, West Texas, couldn't sustainably be over $100 a barrel, which kind of led us to rethink our priors and how much energy exposure we want to have to oil. That being said, I mean, this company has historically had great revenue growth, up 12.7%. over the past 5 years. There's a reason we own it. We own it because it is the gold standard integrated major. And they just keep producing. They keep buying back shares, that $20 billion in buybacks, record production. You know, again, the Iran war situation may remove the near-term oil price tailwind, but Exxon's original plan for growth didn't really anticipate $90 oil in order to work. I think that having a reasonable position towards oil makes sense. And I think amongst those oil names, Exxon is one of the best. Thanks for the call. This is Invest Talk. I'm Luke Guerrero, and we have one goal here, one mission each and every day. That's to help you achieve your financial freedom. Our work continues after this break. It is our final break before I get to watch the U.S. men's soccer team, which I'm very excited about. So get your questions in now at 888-99-CHART.
Got a question for Justin or Luke? You're the best person to ask it.
Is it a good idea to sell your losses in a Roth IRA and just use whatever you have left to reinvest into better stocks?
InvestTalk is ready 24/7.
I would really appreciate if you could give me an entry point for a company called Medtronic, MDT.
Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART, or post your questions on the InvestTalk YouTube channel.
The InvestTalk phone lines never close. And now Luke Guerrero is here. Call InvestTalk, 888-99-CHART.
MicroStrategy, I guess it's called Strategy Now, was essentially built on this premise where you use overvalued stock to buy Bitcoin, and as long as the market values the company at a premium to what the actual Bitcoin is holding, well, then effectively the money printer never stops. Michael Saylor came up with this idea and actually even created his own metric to track it called MNAV, which shows the company's enterprise value as a multiple of its Bitcoin stash. Effectively, when MNAV was above one, it meant the market was paying a premium for the privilege of owning Bitcoin through Saylor's corporate wrapper. And that premium was the fuel for him to issue more stock, issue more debt, in order to buy more Bitcoin. Sounds fancy. The problem, MNAV dropped below one, meaning the premium became a discount. And roll-ups don't work really that well in the opposite direction. There's a reason why the stock is down over 70% over the past year. There's a reason why, at the end of last month, the company announced it had authorized selling up to $1.25 billion in Bitcoin to buy back shares and cover interest and preferred stock dividends. That is a stunning, stunning reversal for a company whose entire identity was effectively built on never selling. But the situation in a lot of ways is a bit worse than what MNAV suggests because it has a design flaw. To calculate enterprise value, what they did was they used the face value of their debt and preferred stock, not their market value. The debt's trading at a 7% discount. The preferred shares are at a 28% discount. So when MNAV showed 0.99, the real number using market values was like 89.89. Even after a recent rebound to 109, the market adjusted figure is only 104. The metric that is being used is artificially inflated. Now, Strategy, for what it's worth, holds about 4% of the Bitcoin that will ever exist, roughly $50 billion worth. It does have a roughly $2.5 billion cash buffer, which gives it about a year and a half of runway to cover those interest and preferred dividends without selling the crypto. But if the market values the company at a sustained discount, there's no choice. You have to sell. Look what happened when they did a small test sale in May. Just 32 Bitcoin. That dragged Bitcoin's price down. Then they had a larger sale last week of over 3,000. And how did they attract people? How did they lure people in? Crazy dividends. I mean, they raised the dividend on their largest preferred series to 12%. The goal of that is to support a stock price that no longer mathematically makes sense. I mean, in a lot of ways, it's a pretty desperate move for a company that's essentially nothing but a leveraged Bitcoin holding vehicle. So, I mean, here's what I'm trying to get at. This is what happens when you financialize a commodity thesis beyond the point of sustainability. At its peak, and when it was working, it was brilliant financial engineering. But as with everything that is built on a house of cards, at some point it stops working. Now, it's what it always was. It's a cautionary tale about what happens when the premium that fueled the engine starts to evaporate. And in that scenario, the leverage that amplified your returns, you learn pretty quickly they work the other way as well. So if you own the stock or if you own Bitcoin and worry about a large forced seller entering the market, this is really, really, really important for you to watch because given how much they hold, it could have a huge negative effect on the value of your Bitcoin. Well, folks, that does it for another episode of Invest Talk. Justin and I thank you for listening and encourage you to tell your friends and family members about our free podcast downloads, which of course you can get at iTunes or Spotify. And while you're at it, we encourage you to watch our videos and post your questions on our YouTube channel. Just search Invest Talk with two T's. Lastly, I want to mention our practice at KPP Financial of parallel investing, where we make a trade for our clients. We do the same trade for ourselves, the same day, the same price, same percentage, no front running, no special treatment. We invest alongside our clients in order to share the same risks and potential for success. If that sounds like a quality you want in your advisor, I encourage you to head over to investtalk.com and click on the free portfolio review button because Justin and I speak with investors just like yourselves each and every day. Independent thinking, shared success. This is Invest Talk. Good night.
Invest Talk is a trademark of KPP Financial. Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for the listener to understand that not all comments made will apply to them. Specifically, nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell security. Because such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor firm, which retains all rights. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. Thank you for listening, and your comments and questions are welcome on our 24-hour listener line at 888-99-CHART.